From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. This morning, President Donald Trump tweeted his congratulations to House Republicans, who passed a budget measure yesterday by a slim margin, a move which paves the way for the GOP to make major changes to the tax code if they can muster the vote. When House Speaker Paul Ryan was asked if he was concerned that Trump might undermine the still-evolving tax plan, he joked that the president will be out of the country next week.
He's going to be in Asia, number one. Number two, no, I'm just kidding. That was kind of a joke. I was just sort of joking on that one. No, I'm not, because we're working very, very closely with the White House on this.
Well, of course, and the speaker knows, as others have noted, Meghna, that you can tweet from Asia. It can happen. It was a week in which two retiring Republican senators said President Trump debased democracy and the presidency. The president accused Hillary Clinton of a uranium sale to Russia, but his campaign data firm contacted WikiLeaks. People want to know why. So lots to chew in. Let's start our virtual weekend roundtable with Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
To be with you.
And start with this accusation. On the campaign trail, Donald Trump accused Hillary Clinton of improperly selling off American uranium interests to Russia when she was Secretary of State. Today's news is that the president joined Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley in pushing to lift a gag order on an FBI informant who claims to have evidence of corruption in that deal. But fact checkers have debunked any accusations. There's no evidence of wrongdoing or corruption by then-Secretary of State Clinton. Why is this coming back this week?
Because this fits a political narrative for the president and Republicans on Capitol Hill. And I actually think it's telling that they're pursuing this from the White House and with the cooperation of Senate Republicans, even in that week where, as you mentioned, Senator Bob Corker, Senator Jeff Flake are out there saying this president basically isn't even presidential. I think they still have enough allies on Capitol Hill, even if that means fighting very old battles. They're going back, and as the president is saying, he's trying to prove collusion between Hillary Clinton and the Russians, even as the evidence mounts about the investigations that are seeking to prove collusion between his campaign and the Russians.
Yeah.
Well, we've got Enrique Acevedo with Univision with us now. Hi there, Enrique.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. So, in addition to the question that Robin asked of Rick, I want to throw this one out there, that this week we also learned that both the Trump and Clinton campaigns did attempt to discredit the other last year, the Clinton campaign and the DNC helping fund research that became part of that infamous pre-election dossier on Trump and his possible ties to Russia. But then on the other hand, the data firm used by the Trump campaign reached out to WikiLeaks about seeking out thousands of emails that Hillary Clinton may have deleted from her private server. So on both sides, lots of stuff going on. Enrique, do you think these are troublesome developments?
Well, I think it's pretty normal during the campaigns. I don't know if it's a positive or a negative development, but it's normal to see opponents trying to get research on the other candidate. We've seen it not only in presidential races, but in local and state elections also. So I don't think people are surprised that this was going on, and they shouldn't be. I think it's common practice, whether we like it or not, that people want to know more about their opponents, especially if you know, in a campaign as negative as the one we experienced in 2016.
Well, this op research, as you say, it's commonly done. But Rick, this is also reminding us, because it's being brought up again, the BBC is reminding us that this dossier, which was put together by a former British spy, was originally funded by Republicans. They were using it to try to take down Donald Trump before they knew he was going to be their party's candidate. They dropped it, and then the Democrats picked it up only after the Republicans dropped it. The president tweeted this morning, "It is now commonly agreed after many months of costly looking, there was no collusion between Russia and Trump, was collusion with HC," meaning that she colluded in this dossier. Your thoughts about reaching back like that and being reminded this was Republican-funded research to start?
A mystery Republican still. We don't know who initially employed the firm that ended up leading to the dossier. I think it gets to the point Enrique makes. Opposition research is a very typical thing. Of course, candidates try to use that information. Much more important, ultimately, is whether the things in the dossier were accurate. Some of them are widely debunked. Others are not. And, of course, what investigators find about the collusion question, because it isn't widely accepted, despite what President Trump said, that is a settled question. We have congressional inquiries. We have Bob Mueller's inquiry that's still outstanding. And there's parts of the dossier that remain kind of unproven one way or the other. I think it's important, the point that the president's trying to make is just that this is some kind of a conspiracy to try to bring him down. That is not shown, and I think you're right. The bipartisan nature of the funding of the dossier is just one indication of that.
Yeah.
And if I may, Robin, I would just add that it feels like we're in the middle of the 2016 presidential race again. And who's benefiting from that? I think in a way, President Trump knows that his base, it seems, it's unconditional. But the coalition that brought him to the White House is not. And there are a lot of people that are part of that coalition that are more anti-Clinton than pro-Trump. So by keeping Hillary Clinton in the conversation, by keeping her under the spotlight, I think he's betting on profiting from that in the 2018 midterm election and probably in 2020. As long as she's there, those anti-Clinton voters might go with Trump.
Mm-hmm. Also, I mean, I remain a details obsessive because there's the outstanding question of who the collusion was with, and that matters. But let's move on to other things that are percolating in Congress here, taxes specifically. I mean, Rick, how significant was the passage of that budget resolution yesterday?
It's an important first step, but only that. And you're seeing real struggles that the Republicans have in even getting to the starting line, much less the finish line. They can't agree on the basics of what to do with state and local tax deductions. They can't agree on what to do with 401ks. And we don't even have a bill for opponents to start firing at yet. And I think it's telling you, we played that joke from Paul Ryan out at the top. He also made another joke earlier this week that the thing that calms him down, his yoga mantra right now, is tax cuts, tax cuts. And it's amazing to me how much the Republicans have riding at this moment on tax cuts. They're banking everything on it.
Well, but on the other side, it's how to pay for it, how to pay for it. And you guys mentioned the, you know, whether or not this will be through limiting deductions for state and local taxes. There are states that are in an uproar over that. Contributions to 401k retirement plans, that was a bubble that was floated, said to be shot down. You know, this idea that you could limit how much people could sock away of untaxable money for their retirement and maybe use that money to pay for this huge deficit. These cuts are
a fraction
expected.
Of it, yeah.
Right. Well, yesterday on Fox News, the host, Bill Hemmer, pressed White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders on what's in the bill.
But again, the question is whether or not the 401k plan changes. Does it or not, Sarah?
Look, I'm not going to negotiate those deals right now, right here. The president is going to do that. But what I can tell you, Bill, is the president is 100% committed to making sure that we're protecting people's retirements, particularly those in the middle class, and making sure that their futures are preserved moving forward.
So it might change then.
Rick, that's Fox News pressing them. This is a tough one.
Well, it's a tough one because the only big way to get that money is to limit those the contributions of 401ks, but that's a very popular program that has millions of Americans saving for retirement. We know we don't save enough as a country, and the president ruled it out, even touching it earlier in the week. I think it's one indication, just a little glimpse of how difficult it is to negotiate with a president who often negotiates on Twitter and is prone to just make a commitment on the side. That's what has so many Republicans frustrated, again, even before the debate begins.
Yeah. I want to jump to the other extraordinary things we saw this past week. Senator Flake announcing his retirement on the Senate floor 2 days ago.
We were not made great as a country by indulging in or even exalting our worst impulses, turning against ourselves, glorifying in the things that divide us, and calling fake things true and true things fake.
So, Enrique, five others have joined Senator Flake now in incredible language calling out the president. But others are pointing out that many of them are, you know, that Flake wasn't going to win anyway.
Well, this is remarkable considering it's coming from a Republican senator only 9 months into the Trump administration. This is coming from the heart of the American democracy, the Senate. So, you know, talking about not waiting and staying silent and being complicit, I think it's extraordinary. After Trump's inauguration, Senate Republicans were unwilling to appear on Univision, Robin. Mm-hmm. And Jeff Flake was the only exception. I think he's a good man. He's a man who speaks his conscience, and that's what we saw him do this week.
Well, another thing that's dividing the GOP is immigration right now. This week, House Speaker Paul Ryan said he would not actually put a date on when lawmakers would vote on a fix to the DACA program, that protects some young undocumented immigrants from deportation.
We want to work on a DACA solution in such a way that we don't have a DACA problem 5-10 years down the road. And that means we have to address border security and interior enforcement as a part of that. How and when we do that is an ongoing conversation that we're having.
Enrique, your response to that?
Well, this is an interesting issue. Oddly enough, I think the election in Virginia is going to decide what's going to happen with DACA in Congress. And what I mean by that is that many Republicans in both the House and the Senate are going to look at that race and what's going on with immigration and the way it's being used in that campaign to see if there is an incentive or a penalty, whether they support that guy or not. Those are on the fence because there's clearly people who don't want to support that guy and those who do. But for those who are on the fence, they're going to find in the result of the Virginia election either the incentive to support that guy or the lack of any penalty in trying to cancel or reject any deal.
Enrique Acevedo, news anchor at Univision. And by the way, we're also following the story of the 10-year-old Mexican girl with cerebral palsy who's being detained by immigration officials in her hospital bed in Texas. She's been getting medical help through Medicaid. Some are saying, why wouldn't you help that girl? Others are saying that's an example of an undocumented immigrant receiving Medicaid in this country. So that story is moving to the center as well. Enrique, Rick Klein, also political director at ABC News, thank you both so much for helping us round up the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you again.
Star Trek is back on television. It premiered on CBS All Access last month. But is Star Trek Discovery breaking new ground? Let's get NPR's Eric Deggans' take on this. Hi.
Hey.
So Discovery is a prequel to the original Star Trek series. But in many ways, this one is particularly groundbreaking. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, Star Trek has always been known as a franchise that prizes diversity, but it's never had a show that was focused on a black woman. Mm-hmm. And so Discovery is focused on Sonequa Martin-Green's character, Michael Burnham. It's also hasn't had a series that's focused on somebody who's not a captain. Michael Burnham, the character, is actually Starfleet's first mutineer. And in the first two episodes, we get an explanation of how that came to be. And then there's also this weird rule that they used to have in Star Trek where the core characters couldn't have longstanding grievances against each other because it was supposed to be a utopian society.
Yeah.
And in the first episode, Michael Burnham's character even attacks her captain, physically attacks her. And there's a great scene where there's even a little allusion to a little PC debate about how to treat the Klingons and their predilection for aggressiveness and violence. Let's listen to that clip.
The ideal outcome for any Klingon interaction is battle. They're relentlessly hostile, sir. It's in their nature.
The Federation and the Klingon Empire have always been on the cold side of war. And now you presume to know their motivation because it is in their nature? Considering your background, I would think you're the last person to make assumptions based on race.
With respect, it would be unwise to confuse race and culture.
So considering her background, meaning she's a Vulcan?
Considering that she's a black woman is what I thought that was a reference to. She's a black woman who was adopted by the Vulcan ambassador to the Federation when her parents were killed.
Okay. So because she's a black woman, you say that that clip carried the particular weight for you. So tell me more about that.
There's been a lot of talk about diversifying science fiction movies like Star Wars, where we now have a woman leading the action and we also have a black man. People say, well, this is a show about aliens. Why does whether the character is black or white matter? But these stories are still conceived and sort of told from a cultural perspective. So to have a science fiction show like Star Trek, as important as Star Trek, where the lead character is not white, that automatically forces the storytelling to change a little bit.
Can I just jump in here, Eric? I feel really strongly about this.
Sure.
Sci-fi is a big world, but I guess what I'm saying is I agree with you because Star Trek has always been a kind of sci-fi where it may have aliens and it may be set in the future, but it's definitely a story about us now.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Every good science fiction story, it is about us and it's about now. So when you look at the old Star Trek, that old Star Trek is about 1960s era America. And particularly 1960s America through the eyes of some of these progressive TV producers who were trying to talk about war and trying to talk about civil rights and trying to talk about all the stuff that was going on at the time. But the TV powers that be would not let them do that. And now this Star Trek Discovery is trying to be about now in that same way. And it's told in a way where you can get at the emotion of it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it's always done a good job of, you know, using aliens and androids and whatnot to sort of explore otherness.
Exactly. And what's interesting about Star Trek is that it has also had its blind spots.
Yeah.
When you want to talk about sexism, you want to talk about how in the classic Star Trek, women wore miniskirts. And the question of how are women treated on these shows, that's always been something that Star Trek has kind of struggled with. And so, again, it's important to see a woman center stage with a lot of agency in a very complex story. All of that is very important, too. And Star Trek has had some blind spots in terms of race. I've always talked about the Klingons and the fact that the show's legendary bad guys are dark-skinned. Uh-huh. And they're characters that seem to get more dark-skinned in every iteration of Star Trek. And, you know, is there a sense that that makes them more menacing? I don't know. But it is troubling as a black man to see that. So there are still, you know, issues of race and culture and gender that Star Trek is still grappling with, you know, even in the modern age.
Yeah. Well, that's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans. Eric, live long and prosper.
Always a pleasure.
Well, to Northern California now, where this fall the number of Chinook salmon making their way from the sea up the Klamath River is the lowest on record. That's devastating news for the Yurok tribe, which has lived along and fished the Klamath for centuries. Lisa Morehouse has our report.
Cousins Erica Chavez and Jerome Nick Jr. are patrolling the Klamath. Nick perching in the front of the boat, Chavez at the helm.
Where are we headed?
The mouth. Tribal members fishing. Yeah. Then we're going to head up to the bridge, see if there's anybody else up there. What's this right over here?
They work for the Yurok Tribal Fisheries Department, but today they're also volunteering, catching salmon for tribal elders. It's the only fishing allowed this year. They stop to check a net.
No fish.
No fish?
No fish.
The cousins are alone on the water today. In a normal year, during commercial fishing season,
this whole area has been almost all the way, with nets all the way up to the bridge.
I mean, this year is so different.
Yeah, it's like a ghost town out here because there's nobody out.
Chavez tells me she grew up with her family camping right here for the summer.
My partner was my auntie. She's the one that taught me. And our whole bottom of our boat was just filled with fish.
A rich salmon harvest means covering the basics. Money for kids' school clothes, salmon for food. Chavez usually fishes for her grandma.
Get her at least 10 to 15 fish every year, so it's in her freezer for the whole year.
But not this year.
She'll have to deal with deer meat or elk meat or something.
This is the 55th Annual Salmon Festival. We'd like to welcome everybody. The parade is underway.
Thousands of Yurok and friends gather every August for the tribe's salmon festival. There's a parade and a traditional stick game. And true to the festival's name, there's salmon cooked in the traditional Yurok way. Oscar Jensa wears a t-shirt that reads Fish Boss. He monitors a long, narrow fire pit with salmon skewered on redwood sticks, forming a kind of crown.
My main goal is just to be able to pass this on to my boys, so one day I can just be the ultimate fish boss and sit on the side while they cook. So.
But he wants to teach them with salmon caught in the Klamath, not the fish he's cooking with today.
I believe these come from Alaska.
The tribe had to buy this salmon the first time in festival history. So few Chinook salmon were expected to return to spawn this year that Yurok were allowed to catch just over 600 salmon in a tribe of 6,000. Those low numbers are the end result of drought and disease and a long history of habitat destruction. Yurok placed much of the blame on upstream dams that have blocked salmon from ancient spawning grounds for over a century. In the parade, Analia Hillman commands the megaphone for the Klamath Justice Coalition. Hillman's a youth social worker. She says the river's poor health and the low salmon run impacts the whole Yurok culture and way of life.
When we can't be in our river, when we can't eat our fish, it kind of
takes our purpose away. And we have one of the highest suicide rates. And I think that's directly correlated to the lack of salmon and our inability to continue our way of life.
This has been a long struggle. In the 1960s, California game wardens arrested many Yurok for gillnet fishing on the river, a practice banned by the state. One young man, Raymond Matz, challenged the arrests. His fight went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which reaffirmed the tribe's reservation status and fishing rights.
If you want to try some, lemon pepper.
Thank you.
His nephew, Paul Matz Van Mechelen, runs Paul's Famous Smoked Salmon on Highway 101. Customers know he's open if there's smoke coming from the traditional fire pit in front.
Where do you usually get your stock from?
Klamath River. Not the last 2 years, though. Had to go to Columbia River.
Hundreds of miles away in Oregon, buying from native fishermen there. That gets expensive for a business owner who usually fishes about 50 feet away from here. But the losses are more than financial.
Like I got a niece, great niece with me. She's only two. But, you know, she helped start up the boat, you know, smiled and did all that last year. But her auntie was five when she pulled in a fish. So that whole part of learning and teaching them who they are and what this river gives to them is kind of life in one way.
I asked Van Mechelen to explain that, how fishing is who Yurok are. He gets emotional, even stepping out of the store for a minute before answering.
I had my grandma at a young age tell me that I had fish blood. Didn't understand it, didn't know why, but, you know, we're all fishing people. You know, you got to look down where we're from.
And when you have fish blood and have to stay away from fishing in hopes of keeping salmon here in the future?
Yeah, it's sad to stay next to the river and wake up and not see fish go by. That's the saddest part.
He says all he can do is pray the salmon come back. For Here and Now, I'm Lisa Morehouse.
Survivors of the mass shooting in Las Vegas have long physical and emotional recoveries ahead of them. They're also starting to realize the financial toll of the shooting. Anna Gorman of our partner Kaiser Health News has this report.
On the night of the mass shooting in Las Vegas, Sunrise Hospital became the epicenter for the victims. 41-year-old Michael Castor was one of them.
Everyone starts taking off running. We start doing the same, and then I get shot through the back, through my lungs, and into my spine, so I drop to the floor. I cannot walk.
Now, Castor is paralyzed from the waist down. He may never walk again and has months, if not years, of rehab ahead of him. Castor works in human resources at a California hospital and has health insurance, but his mother, Patricia, isn't sure how the family will pay all his medical bills.
I do worry about it. I think it is going to be very, very expensive. But at this point, the main thing is that he gets healthy again.
So far, Castor's family has raised more than $25,000 on the fundraising website GoFundMe.
I don't want to be stuck with a bunch of bills. You know, that'd be unfortunate.
Michael Castor was one of more than 500 people injured in the shooting. Garen Wintemute is a doctor at UC Davis who studies gun violence.
The medical care costs alone would measure in the tens of millions of dollars.
Research shows that the hospital costs for treating one gunshot victim are more than $100,000. And the total hospital costs from gun violence in the U.S. come to almost $3 billion every year. And that's just the beginning. Victims may not be able to return to work for months, if at all. Many will have lost wages and added costs at the same time. Wintemute says it's hard to quantify.
We really don't have a good handle on the intangible costs of something like this. The ripple effects on family and friends, on neighborhoods when a large number of people have been shot.
Taxpayers will also be on the hook for those on public insurance like Medicaid and Medicare. And hospitals won't be reimbursed for all the care they provide. Back at Sunrise Hospital, neurosurgeon Keith Blum sits down with Mary Moreland. Her daughter, Tina Frost, lost her right eye during the Las Vegas shooting when a bullet exploded in her brain. She spent 2 weeks in a medically induced coma.
You know, we got a long ways to go, and there could be, you know, some good days and some bad days, but in general, she's in a much better spot now than where we started.
Today she squeezed my hand.
In the months to come, Tina Frost will need multiple operations and a slew of specialists. Plastic surgeons, occupational therapists, mental health counselors. Moreland says she can't even begin to imagine what her daughter's medical bills will be. Frost has health insurance through her job as an accountant in California, but that won't cover everything. There's the deductible, co-pays, and other out-of-pocket expenses.
Being realistic, knowing what I know about costs of health care, it's scary, but she's alive.
Moreland says she didn't understand at first why everyone was setting up online fundraisers. But family friends started one, and so far it's raised about $570,000. Moreland starts to cry.
I'd give it all back just to have my daughter back.
Lawmakers are beginning to recognize the significant expenses facing victims, too. They're asking health insurers to reduce the medical costs. And in Las Vegas, a county commissioner set up a GoFundMe account for the families. It's raised $11 million. For Here and Now, I'm Anna Gorman in Las Vegas.
The National Book Awards will be given out next month, so there's time to read the 5 finalists for fiction if you haven't already, and you can get in on the office pool. They are Elliot Ackerman's Dark at the Crossing, Min Jin Lee's Pachinko, Carmen Maria Machado's Her Body and Other Parties, Sing Unburied Sing by Jesmyn Ward, and The Leavers, a debut novel by Asian-American author Lisa Koh that takes a deeply personal look at immigration and adoption. Now, this is not the first honor for Lisa. The Leavers won the 2016 Penn Bellwether Prize for Socially Engaged Fiction. In the novel, we meet Deming Goh. He's born in America, but his mother Polly is an undocumented immigrant from China who works in a nail salon. The pair live in a crammed apartment in the Bronx with a makeshift family of other immigrants. There are cockroaches and 2 to a mattress, but they speak the same language and there is joy. Then, when Deming is 11, Polly goes to work one day and just doesn't come home. Deming is left to look for answers.
Like a detective inspecting the same 5 seconds of surveillance video he replayed last Wednesday afternoon, walking the blocks from school to home. Again and again, Deming and Mama crossed Fordham Road, waited at the light, slipped on the ice, hugged, Mrs. Johnson forever watching. He zoomed in on the frames, slow-motioned their walk up University, then reversed it, so they goose-stepped downhill, cars and buses groaning backwards. He picked apart the words she said, hunting for clues, the way his English teachers made them read poems and spend 20 minutes talking about a sentence, the meaning behind the meaning. The meaning behind her telling him about her life, the meaning of her not coming home.
Lisa Koh, reading from her novel, The Leavers. So, did Mom just walk out on Deming? She owed some money. Was she killed? Was she deported? Well, Deming, the son, is ultimately adopted by a well-meaning white couple who change his name to Daniel, move him to upstate New York. He's the only Asian there. We spoke with Lisa Koh back when The Leavers was first published in May and began by asking about what inspiration the book had in Lisa's own life, growing up as one of the few Asians in her town in New Jersey.
A lot of the emotion does come from there, especially the chapters where Deming's transported from the big city to this small town and he's suddenly super out of place in his new home.
Where was your family from?
We're ethnically Chinese, but my parents were born and raised in the Philippines. And I was born in New York and raised, as you said, in New Jersey.
You were born and raised here,
mm-hmm.
but still felt what when you were the only Asian or one of the only Asians in a white community? And what did you give to your character, Daniel?
In earlier drafts, his life was a little too bleak, and I really wanted to give him more joy. So I gave him a best friend. I gave him music. He's a musician, and he really falls in love with music. And that was something that I really related to and that partly came from my own experience. Growing up in this suburban town where I felt like I didn't belong, there was a way that I could use it to my advantage and that
in so many ways, that was why I became a writer and an artist. So claiming music for myself and sort of falling in love with that was a way to create an identity outside of these other identities.
Yeah, but you also have these sort of wince-inducing, well-meaning white parents who, first of all, change his name from his birth name that he'd had for 10 years.
They just want him to fit in.
Want him to fit in. He has that moment that you pray a child has where he finds his father's old Jimi Hendrix records, loves them, and yet everyone says, oh, no, 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 you have to be a good student and be responsible. And,
right.
You know, that they take it away.
Yeah. I mean, they don't want him to be Jimi Hendrix. They just want him to listen to Jimi
Hendrix.
Well,
do they want him to be a model minority, which he's not?
Yeah. And, you know, I think one of the things I wanted to explore in the book was this question of what does it mean to be a fit parent? A lot of the news stories that I was inspired by had U.S. courts saying adoptive American families have the resources to be better parents. So to me, I was really interested in that question. And his adoptive parents have social and economic capital, and they're really kind of, as professors, pressuring him to be like them, you know, and to reassure them that their choices are the right ones.
Well, when you say in the accounts that you were reading, that's the other inspiration you had. You read news stories, including one about the detention of an undocumented immigrant who lost her child to the foster system.
Yeah, and there are actually many cases of this that I read about. Parents have been deported or detained, and they're not allowed to take their kids with them, even if they want to.
Because the kids were born here.
Because the kids were born here, but, you know, it's really heartbreaking. And it also brings up a lot of questions about identity and family, because the U.S. government is saying these kids belong in the U.S. with adoptive parents who are mainly white and middle class, not with their birth parents.
Right. I think this book is uniquely a story about Asian immigrants. It's uniquely that on one level. But I was thinking you could read this through other prisons. You know, anyone who's taken out of a poverty situation, taken away from a parent, and is suddenly in a home the way Deming Daniel is his name when he gets his name gets changed. And he's looking, there's more rooms in his home in upstate New York than in his entire tenement.
Right.
He marvels that his adoptive mother just swipes a credit card and gets him something. Like, what's that? There's sort of anger about it.
Yeah.
You know, discovering inequity.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's interesting because it's not a really large geographical migration, like from China to New York. It's from a city in New York to a small town in New York, but it's still a really big distance psychologically for him.
Yeah. This is one of the first Asian characters we've read in a long time that he's not good at school.
Yeah.
You know, he's not good at his studies. But what's happening inside him? What's going on?
Well, you know, he's a young boy who's lost everything he's known. His mother has disappeared. He doesn't know why. He struggles with these issues of abandonment and loss. He's really going through a lot of trauma and mourning. And he's not given the tools in his new family to really process this.
He's not allowed to hold on to his identity.
No, he's not.
Yeah,
nobody really understands, right? So that's kind of behind his status as a student.
Well, you just look at food. They make him drink milk because they think it's good for him. It makes him sick.
Right.
And you have him go back to visit this childhood friend that he grew up with in this crammed apartment building. And he just chows down on tofu, beef, mushroom casserole, greens with garlic, crispy pork, whole steamed fish.
Oh, I'm getting hungry. I think there's a way that smelling food that he hasn't smelled for a long time kind of is just this shortcut way of bringing him back to his childhood. You know, there's a way that smell is the most powerful way to access nostalgia and memory. And suddenly having access to that when he visits is just this amazing kind of emotional way of reconnecting to that.
Yeah. He becomes something of a screw-up, not unlike a lot of 20-somethings, but we know it's because he's so unmoored.
Yeah.
We're not going to give away the ending, but it's heartbreaking when you see how disrupted lives are when, let's just say, we remind you again, she was undocumented, and this country has policies. Are you trying to say something about those policies, or is it just about, here's what happens when your identity gets wrenched and you don't know who you are?
I think what compelled me in the first place to write about this was just how shocked and horrified I was at learning about a lot of these policies and the effects they had on families. The questions that these stories raised regarding family and identity and culture and assimilation were ultimately the most interesting and what kind of drove it.
Yeah. It also seems like a book that should be written about adopting parents, about any child that comes from a culture that maybe is different from your own. Maybe what honor that culture. Don't try to erase it.
Right. Yeah. And to me, it's really interesting about the idea even of culture, because it's definitely not something that's static. I think a lot of the ways that we talk about immigration and culture in the U.S. kind of has this idea of like one static culture meeting another static culture. and in reality, you know, assimilation is a lot more complicated than that. And I'm interested in the reasons why we're asked to assimilate and into what and why.
Yeah. By the way, we just a note for all writers out there, you weren't getting anything going, no traction. And so you set yourself a goal of 50 rejections a year.
Yeah, I ended up a few years ago trying to aim for rejections rather than acceptances when I sent out my work. It just felt a little easier for me, a kind of glasses half empty type person.
Well, yeah. Well, I got a rejection. Well, I'm moving towards 50.
So you're celebrating it instead of feeling really distraught, even though you kind of feel distraught. But yeah, I sent out this manuscript on a whim to the Penn Bellwether Prize, which is funded and established by Barbara Kingsolver. Totally forgot about it. And then 6 months later, I got a phone call from Barbara telling me I'd won.
And you went, oh, darn, I was looking for that 49th rejection.
Now I'll never reach that goal now. I'll turn it down.
Lisa Koh, her debut novel is The Leavers. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
We spoke back in May. And again, for all of those who rejected her and those who've collected those slips, her book The Leavers is now a finalist for the National Book Award on November 15th.
A couple of notes about Puerto Rico post-Hurricane Maria. The Federal Emergency Management Agency says it had no involvement in the decision to award a $300 million contract to help restore Puerto Rico's power grid to a company with ties to Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. That contract went to Whitefish Energy Holdings, a tiny company from Zinke's hometown in Montana. FEMA issued a statement today stating that any language in the contract saying the agency had approved the deal with Whitefish is inaccurate. The statement adds that FEMA's initial review raised significant concerns about how Whitefish won the contract and whether the contracted costs are reasonable. Congress is also taking a look at this. In the meantime, Puerto Rico's Governor Ricardo Rossello may visit New York next week to see how the state rebuilt after Superstorm Sandy in 2012. New York's Governor Andrew Cuomo returned last night from his second visit to the island following Hurricane Maria, and he said conditions in Puerto Rico remain deplorable. Cuomo said the federal response to Puerto Rico was, quote, wholly, wholly unacceptable. Well, it was 5 years ago this Sunday that Superstorm Sandy made landfall in the U.S., first hitting near Atlantic City, New Jersey. Sandy devastated many Jersey Shore communities and flooded small towns along Delaware Bay. Mary Cummings Jordan of WHYY reports on how Sandy permanently changed those towns.
Bay Point, New Jersey is a tiny community along the Delaware Bay, far removed from the hustle of modern life. So quiet, you can hear the water lapping and the wind blowing through the grasses. A row of pilings lines the bayside, some still supporting empty homes, which sport large orange numbers, marking them for demolition. Sandy dealt this bayfront community a nearly lethal blow. Most of the few dozen properties along the bay and nearby creek will be torn down this winter. Just a few residents are choosing to stay. Irwin Shepherd was Lawrence Township mayor 5 years ago. He says this means the loss of about $1 million in tax revenue and more.
It's significant because this is our only bayfront community in the township. And there was a lot of economic activity in the town because they came in and went to the local restaurant, the local convenience store, all those people that were coming for the weekends. So that's been a little bit of a loss.
A few years ago, the Bay Point Marina was still operating, a local gathering spot for crabbing, surf fishing, and striped bass tournaments. It's little more than a boat launch and a pile of greenish rubble now. Bay Point is the latest loss, but the locals could tell you of neighboring towns like Moores Beach, Seabreeze, and Thompson's Beach, all hit by challenging storms in recent decades. All are pretty much gone. Megan Wren is a longtime resident of Money Island, another community battered by Sandy. Wren says when it comes to help from the state, location matters.
The treatment that the Bayshore communities are getting is very, very different than the Atlantic coastal communities that are racking in a lot of tourism funds. And so we definitely get a lot less attention, a lot less funding, and I believe they'd, you know, the big they would be happier to see us all gone.
Vaughn McGee is director of the state's Blue Acres program, which buys up properties from people willing to move to higher ground. She says there have been more than 1,000 flood events in New Jersey since the mid-1990s, and that the Delaware Bayshore area is particularly vulnerable to flooding and storm surge. McGee says the state doesn't ask residents to leave. They choose to sell. And she says queries from potential sellers keep coming.
As much as they may not want to move away from this area, they recognize how vulnerable it is. And so we're here to help. There's money, so we'll continue to do it.
Once properties are demolished, McGee says the goal is to restore a healthy ecosystem.
Because it will be owned by the state and offer public access, we are hopeful that we create healthy natural habitats for our shorebirds and our horseshoe crabs, and we have the opportunity for the public to get out and to enjoy that natural area.
Meantime, Megan Wren says one half of the village of Money Island has been sold and is awaiting demolition. Money Island is the primary landing spot for the Delaware Bay oyster industry. To her, the idea that this little piece of bayshore paradise will shrink is wrenching.
It'll have a very different feel. It won't feel like a village. It'll feel like we're living in an outpost. I've spoken to a number of people who are just devastated that, you know, they had moved here, retired here, planned to make their forever home, and they're feeling as though they don't have any choice but to sell now because the whole community is kind of picking up and leaving, and it's not going to be the way they had thought it would be.
The plan is to restore much of the bayshore to natural wetlands that can absorb floodwaters. Wren says there is still a need for people who are passionate about the area to live here.
If you just cut it off from human interaction and divorce it from its heritage and the culture of people appreciating it, you're not going to have people taking care of it.
Still, Wren admits she's watched the tides get higher in the 25 years since she's first come to Money Island, and not all communities are necessarily salvageable. For Here and Now, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.